On Wednesday, February 21st, at 8 o'clock in the morning, in the Chapel Royal of the Castle of Rouen, the bishop and 42 assessors present. We did first of all command to be read the royal letters conveying surrender and deliverance of the said woman into our hands. Afterwards, the letters of the Chapter of Rouen making concession of territory for our benefit. This reading ended, Master Jean d'Estivet, nominated by us as a promoter of the case, did, in our presence, show that the aforementioned woman of the name of Jean had been, by the executor of our mandate, cited to appear in this place, at this hour and day, here to answer, according to law, the questions put to her. And in the first instance, we did require her, in the appointed form, her hand on the Holy Gospels, to speak to truth on the questions to be addressed to her. To which she did reply,
I know not upon what you wish to question me. Perhaps you may ask me of things which I ought not to tell you.
Swear, we did say to her, to speak truth on the things which shall be asked you concerning the faith, and of which you know.
Of my father and my mother, and of what I did after taking the road to France, willingly will I swear, but of the revelations which have come to me from God, to no one will I speak or reveal them, save only to Charles my king, and to you I will not reveal them, even if it cost me my head, because I have received them in visions and by secret counsel, and am forbidden to reveal them. Before 8 days are gone, I shall know if I may reveal them to you. Welcome back to the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. I'm Olivia, and this is Aaron, a Burgundian.
That I object to that description. I don't think that would have been my side at all. Actually, no, that's not true. My family hails from that part of the world, so I guess I would be a Burgundian.
Exactly. As we've set up in the last most recent episode, we are doing a three-part series about the Hundred Years' War. So last time we talked about the Scottish Wars of Independence, and this time we are going to be getting more into the actual main events of the war itself and trying to establish how we ended up at that scene that Aaron and I were just reading in the intro, which, if you haven't clocked it already, is a transcript from the trial of Joan of Arc.
That's right. And to get to be really thorough as we're getting there, we're going to be doing this 1 year per episode. Jokes. Where did we leave people in the last episode? I believe we left them with Scotland on the brink of civil war, being invaded by the armies of Edward III. The Scots turned to their relatively newfound allies in France and called on them for assistance. The King of France, in response, dispossessed the King of England of his last holdings in France, and Edward III, in response to that, declared himself King of France and invaded France itself. And that is a very bad thing for a lot of people. So that is the lay of the land at the start of the conflict in 1340. Now, initially, in the very, very early stages of the conflict, it's slightly anticlimactic. There are basically a series of very, very inconclusive skirmishes that happen between the French defenders and the English invaders, until a string of pretty remarkable English victories racks up all of a sudden in the mid-1340s, beginning with the Battle of Crecy.
Yeah, and this is when it really kicks off into a kind of full-fledged war that doesn't rage at the same level continually for 100 years, but very much does so on and off. It keeps coming back. And I think part of our motivation for making these episodes was to try to tell the story from a little bit of a different perspective, to how it's usually told. And so there are probably a million podcasts and books and articles that you can read that will give you a play-by-play of each battle of the war and each person involved and the numbers of people and where they went and what they did. And so it was such a long, drawn-out, I think at times, convoluted conflict. And we only have so much time and space that we're not going to be trying to get into the entire thing, but hopefully what we will manage to do is to give a broad overview of why this war happened, why it was 100 years of war, what that did to the continent of Europe, in particular to England and France, and why that brought us to the trial of Joan of Arc in 1431, almost 100 years later.
Yeah, because I think that a lot of the narrative history about the Hundred Years' War, for me, attempting to string together a kind of a coherent narrative, is almost kind of missing the forest for the trees. The Hundred Years' War, the reason it is such a long conflict, is because has almost no narrative thread. We will sketch out the big picture narrative, but I think one of the things that's very important to remember as you're going through this story is that there are situations and places and times where violence becomes so diffuse and so persistent that it almost becomes constitutive of how people think about places and things. And the most instructive example is probably the way that people in the West write and talk about the Middle East as a region in the wake of the fall of the Ottoman Empire in 1923, where we are used to the conflict in the Middle East being this kind of miasmatic, like never-ending, self-sustaining conflict that sort of defies borders and narratives and extends so far beyond the motivations of anyone who was actually involved in initiating it. The way that the Hundred Years' War would have been experienced by somebody on the ground is not as a story, but as a state of being.
And it was a state of being that was so devastational and so persistent that combined itself with other factors in such a way that it completely transformed life in Europe, not just in the immediate aftermath, but permanently. This really changed the way that society functioned on a structural level. So yeah, and just to put this into perspective a little bit, after this conflict kicked off in 1340, around 8 years later, the Black Death arrived in Europe. So that was, of course, a catastrophe that is still remembered as one of the most destructive and just, you know, completely transformative events. And I think it's, you know, when you're kind of talking about it outside of a historical, analytical narrative, I think a lot of people don't realize that this was something that happened in the midst of 100 years of all-out war between these two major powers. And just to put the level of destruction into perspective, during this time period, the Hundred Years' War, France lost around half of its population. England lost between a fifth and a third of its population. And that was from combined mortality from the war, from the plague, and from all of the chaos that ensued because of those two things. And I think it's impossible, really, for anyone today to imagine the social effects that something like that would have. I mean, I think the easiest comparison to make that we've all lived through is the coronavirus pandemic, which had a minuscule fraction of the impact that these 100 years of history had in Europe. And I would say we're still a little bit messed up.
We're still a bit weird.
Maybe not every single person, but I would say there's still an undercurrent of weirdness.
There are bad vibes in the air.
Yes. And again, that's just a fraction. And in addition to the death and destruction that were wrought by battling and by plague, I think that it would be fair to say that people also sensed a widespread, large-scale breakdown in the rules and the norms that governed society. And I think the part of this that's most frequently brought up is the breakdown of feudalism and the end of serfdom. And that, of course, is often painted as something good, although it wasn't quite as straightforward in practice, because although the massive shortage of laborers and the massive availability of land did offer potential for some average working people to gain a little bit more means and more independence, this was fought at every turn by the nobility and the monarchy, who were constantly trying to pass and enforce laws to keep people from leaving their stations in life, and who were constantly trying to tax them to fund this war. And so I think it can be tempting to say, oh, things got better after feudalism ended, but I think really it just set the stage for, you know, a long-term dissolution of a rigid system that didn't in any way happen instantly. Another thing that I think people gloss over a little bit is the end of chivalry.
Mm.
And so as we've discussed before on this podcast, the so-called chivalric code, it's not binding. You're not obligated to follow it. It's not
even... It's more of a set of guidelines than a
exactly.
set of rules.
Yeah, it's not even, in many cases, you know, written down or agreed upon completely. So when I say the end of chivalry, what I don't mean is that everybody forgot about these ideals, which, as we've discussed, and as you may already know, were things like how you should behave in battle and how you should treat the ladies and how you should be very pious and a good person. When I say that that chivalry was lost, partially what I mean is that there was a widespread loss of faith that the knightly classes who claimed to be bound by this code actually were, that they followed it or valued it in the first place, because, as we'll get into in a minute, as England saw victory in France, especially in the early years of the Hundred Years' War, it was utter destruction in France. Not just for people who were fighting, but for villagers and for townspeople. I mean, the English armies and their allies would just cut through the French countryside and burn and pillage villages completely indiscriminately. And it was just, you know, it would have felt absolutely apocalyptic, I think, to anyone who was living through it.
I think apocalyptic is absolutely the right word. I think it's it would have felt like the end, not just the end of the world as you knew it, but probably the end of the world.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And this was something that people noticed. I mean, writers like Chaucer and ones you might not know as well, like John Gower, wrote critiques of greedy knights and of, you know, this excess violence. Greedy knights in particular, because people, not just, you know, foot soldiers, but also, you know, the nobility and the knights were profiting off of this. They were basically carving up the land that they had conquered, and they were redistributing everything that they found to each other. So it was 100% fair to say that there was a lot of profit-oriented or profit-motivated violence, especially in these earlier stages of the war. And another reason why this so-called chivalric code broke down is that knights were just becoming obsolete at the same time. So we talked in the most recent episode about the utter destruction that Welsh longbows caused at the Battle of Falkirk, that they were this new invention that could just completely rip through entire battalions. They had much greater range and power than the standard bows, which were often crossbows or shorter bows, and they could just be completely, completely destructive. They could be really the deciding factor in battles. And you also had artillery for the first time. You had cannons.
They're not very good, but they do exist.
They're not amazing.
They don't have to be that accurate if they're pointed at a big mass of people.
Yeah, exactly. And they're absolutely horrifying to have pointed at you. I mean, you know, in the first few stories we have about these cannons being brought to battle, we don't actually hear that they were extremely destructive, but we hear that people were absolutely terrified of them because people had never seen anything like this before. So yeah, all of these technologies and the increasing organization and training that was being given to even sort of regular infantry soldiers resulted in knights, meaning armored men on horses with lances and swords, just becoming obsolete. So I think a really good example of this is the Battle of Crecy, which was fought in France in 1346. This was a battle between a small, relatively small English army and a much larger French army. And it began with the English having fled to a hill and positioned themselves defensively at the top of a hill with their Welsh longbowmen. The French, on the other hand, had inferior Genoese crossbowmen. And so the English, having positioned themselves very defensively at the top of this hill, their archers began to engage the opposing side's archers, but because the longbows were so much longer range and more powerful, it basically immediately sent the Genoese running. And so because these guys were mercenaries, they were fleeing in violation of the terms of their agreement. As they were running away, the French, who were ostensibly on their side, actually began to like stab and hack at them as they ran, which just caused the French side to descend into chaos. And all the while, these English and Welsh longbowmen are still sending down this hail of arrows. So by the time the French managed to rally together for a charge, their morale is already failing. They have to fight uphill through all of this boggy ground. And again, the English longbowmen, who can fire very, very quickly and very accurately, English and Welsh longbowmen, are still raining down arrows upon them. And even though a few French people do make it to the front lines of the English, they're repelled very quickly. And you have these horrid, horrid stories of these knights fleeing and the English and Welsh longbowmen raining down arrows upon them as they flee, even as they lay incapacitated on the ground. And it's completely devastating to the French. I mean, they've never seen anything like it and been left at a complete disadvantage by their relatively lesser military capabilities. There's a story that one of the French allies that was there, King John of Bohemia.
Oh yes, the blind king of Bohemia.
Who was blind, but as he was learning about the massive losses that his side was taking, he said, well, I need to do my duty as a leader. And he had 12 of his attendants all tie the reins of their horses together to guide him into battle. And all 13 of them charged into battle and basically were immediately cut down. They all died. So again, only one of the first major battles in the war, but it was completely devastating to the French. And more importantly, it showed how in the face of these utterly, utterly destructive new weapons that were being brought into use, knights were pretty quickly losing their place on the battlefield.
Yep. Crecy very much sets the tone for everything that's about to come.
And so this immediately causes a breakdown as well in social norms, because all of a sudden nobility can't charge into battle on their horse with their armor. They're basically immediately going to be obliterated. And so there is suddenly this disconnect between the chivalric ideal of the leader who charges into battle and what these leaders actually have to do to stay alive, which is not that.
Yeah, so, like I said, Crecy very much sets the tone for the early stages of the war. The English forces really remain mostly on the front foot until the arrival of the Black Death into Europe in the 1350s. And as we were alluding to in the start, it's really not easy to articulate in prose the psychological impact of the Black Death. Everybody knows, if anybody knows anything about the Middle Ages, they know about the Black Death. They know that there was a pandemic that ran through the continent of Europe. It emerged out of somewhere in Central Asia. Nobody really knows. Nobody even really knows, still to this day, what the disease even was. But what we do know is that it arrived in Europe and it just slaughters people. So it probably killed about a third of the population overall in Europe in the mid-14th century, but that is not going to be distributed evenly. There would have been towns and cities and communities that were hit much, much harder, would have been killed almost entirely. In most of the continent, the disease runs through the population for a couple of years and then recedes and then eventually comes back. But in places, in major cities like Paris, it actually becomes endemic because there's simply too many people living too close together for the disease to ever really fade away. And in terms of the psychological impact of the disease, there's a good Welsh poem from the time, because there's a Welsh poem for everything, which describes the Black Death as death coming into our midst like black smoke, a plague which cuts off the young, a rootless phantom which has no mercy for fair countenance. Great is its seething like a burning cinder, a grievous thing of ashy color. It is inescapable. So if you got it, you almost certainly would die, and you would die fairly quickly, and you would die in tremendous pain. And the numbers, when you read about them, they defy comprehension. You know, the pandemic response, if we're going to compare this to COVID, the measures to curtail people's movement in most countries during the coronavirus pandemic were about keeping the infection and death rate low enough that the healthcare system, a modern healthcare system, wouldn't keel over and die. The Black Death is vastly, vastly, vastly more deadly than coronavirus, and these are not societies that have modern healthcare systems. And so as a result, people are dying faster than they can even be buried.
Dying on the streets?
Yes.
I mean, I think just imagine going outside of your house and half the people in your neighborhood that you know are lying dead or dying on the streets.
Yeah, there's just putrefying bodies everywhere. I should say that the church and the various charitable orders basically, and when the disease arrives, they essentially mobilize on the clerical equivalent of a war footing to try and save lives and dispose of the dead, and importantly, give people their last rites so they won't go to hell. And almost immediately, they are overwhelmed.
Yeah,
they are defeated by the scale of the task within weeks, in most places, and the cultural impact of that, of being surrounded by horror and death and always the fear of death, is something that I don't think we can fully quantify today. Certainly, medieval people themselves were utterly unprepared for the psychological experience of this. I mean, the only analogy that I can kind of draw on when I'm trying to understand this are in things like H.P. Lovecraft and just like and the cosmic horror of facing down something that you don't have the tools to understand. You don't have anything that you can do to fight it, and it will just wipe you off the face of the earth.
And I think it goes to show you that this reaction to death is an intrinsic part of the human experience. I mean, on the episode we did ages ago about medieval vampires, we talked about this false perception that life was somehow cheap in the Middle Ages, and that death and dying were seen as pedestrian. And just to reiterate, I think that events like this show that that's absolutely not the case. Whether it's disease or warfare or anything else, I don't think we can strip medieval people of that deeply human tendency to react with complete horror and to be permanently scarred, even. I mean, around the time of the Black Death and the Hundred Years' War, we get writings about trauma and about the marks that these events have left on people. There was a French knight named Geoffrey de Charny who wrote a book about knighthood and chivalry during the Hundred Years' War, who wrote in it as a warning to other knights that, quote, "When they would be secure from danger, they will be beset by great terrors." So basically saying, even when you're safe, you won't feel like it anymore. There are also a couple absolutely horrifying quotes from people who lived through the Black Death that I wanted to read. So here's one from Agnolo di Tura of Siena, who wrote, "Father abandoned child, wife husband, one brother another. For this illness seemed to strike through the breath and sight. And so they died. And none could be found to bury the dead for money or friendship. Members of a household brought their dead to a ditch as best they could, without priest, without divine offices. Great pits were dug and piled deep with the multitude of the dead. And they died by the hundreds both day and night. And as soon as those ditches were filled, more were dug. And I, Agnolo di Tura, buried my 5 children with my own hands. And there were also those who were so sparsely covered with earth that the dogs dragged them forth and devoured many bodies throughout the city. There was no one who wept for any death, for all awaited death. And so many died that all believed it was the end of the world."
And I should say that the Black Death did not lead to an end in the conflict. It's simply, because the disease was seasonal, what would happen is you would fight, and then the disease would sweep through, and then a bunch of people would die, and then you just go back to fighting.
Yeah, you would have plague in the summer and fighting in the winter.
Yeah.
Not great.
No. And there is another dimension to the violence that we haven't really talked about yet, which is the introduction of a thing called free companies. Now, free companies had already existed in Italy for a really, really long time, for about 100 years, because the predominantly urban Italian elites didn't like doing their own fighting. Classic, typical. But what happened in the early years of the Hundred Years' War was that because the English armies were predominantly dependent not on knights, but on professional soldiers, those soldiers needed to be paid. They weren't subject to the same feudal obligations. And so, when it was very common for, after a major victory, for a bunch of soldiers to be released from their contracts. And released from their contracts with nowhere to go and with no obvious way of making money. And so what a lot of these English soldiers did was form bands, some of them just a few men, some of them hundreds, some of them thousands, who would fight for their own interests and for their own pay. These are, again, called the free companies. And these were not fighting for one side or another. They were fighting for themselves. So what they would do, instead of fighting in an army for the King of England or the King of France, they would just go and pillage local towns. They would extort the rich towns, and they would just go and murder the poorer towns. And to defend themselves, a lot of towns would turn their churchyards into fortresses, which they would buttress with walls and wooden staves, and would have to fight to defend them. Quite often, the clanging of church bells no longer called people to prayer, but called them to fight for their lives. In Picardy, some local villagers would retreat down into underground tunnels and only come out when the danger was past. The roads are not safe. The rule of law is starting to completely break down. The largest free companies would seize castles and then use those sort of impenetrable
fortresses as a base from which to terrorize an entire region. And the completely bankrupt French, who are too busy fighting the English and burying their dead, can do basically nothing about it. And the worst part is these become self-sustaining because they start to swell with people, not just English people who have been let loose of their contracts in France, but now adventurers from all over Europe. So Italians and Germans and Scots and Spanish mercenaries are all descending on France to try and just pick this carcass clean. In the chronicles that we have that describe this period, the free companies almost sort of seem to act like these orgiastic death cults that sort of slaughter and burn indiscriminately, rather like out of madness rather than behaving as rational actors. Now, that might seem to be a bit of an exaggeration, but in a world where order is clearly breaking down, the way of things that has been for hundreds of years is starting to collapse, and the social fabric and all the assumptions that you've lived with your whole life are starting to collapse, is that hard to imagine? And I take this a step further, which is to say that the free companies remind me of like a warlord gang from a Mad Max movie. Both in the sense that they are just a bunch of self-interested people terrorizing a small town, as war bands like to do in Mad Max movies, but also in the sense that people in this period are living in a world that would feel post-apocalyptic in many ways.
Oh, it's very beyond Thunderdome.
Yeah, absolutely. And so even if the free companies are not necessarily behaving like, you know, behaving like Humongous or Toe Cutter or Dementus, that's how it probably would have been experienced by local people. The free companies should not be understood as discrete entities or organizations themselves, but as an infestation, a human manifestation of the endemicness of violence. One of the interesting cultural trends that you see in the wake of these events, so in the latter half of the 14th century in France, is a general upsurge of female mysticism, by which I mean like prophetesses, women who would have divine revelations, most of them relating in some way to politics or to the war or to death. And one of the most famous of these was Marie Robine, a peasant woman who went on a pilgrimage to Avignon in 1387, which miraculously healed her of an illness. And after this, she became a hermit, where she was plagued with these increasingly apocalyptic visions. Basically that she concluded that the king of France, who was unable to save the French people, had failed. And she said that we will depose him from his throne by the means of his subjects, and many will die in rivers of blood. And one will say, here was Paris. Before she died, she had one final prophecy. She saw a vision of a vast amount of armor, and fearing that she was the one who was destined to wear it, she protested that she could not be a warrior. And the voices of angels who spoke to her assured her that the armor was not for her, but for a maiden who would come afterwards, should bear these arms and deliver the kingdom of France from the enemy. So the arrival of the Black Death in the 1350s basically froze the battle lines and halted the English advance until 1356 at the Battle of Poitiers, where an English force led by Edward III's son, the Black Prince, which, much as I resent admitting it, is a cool fucking name, once again defeated a much, much larger French army with the able help of the English and Welsh longbowmen, and actually captured the French king, Jean II. Now, they didn't kill the king of France. Instead, they ransomed him for an amount that was 2 to 3 times the entire revenue of the French kingdom at that time. Nevertheless, the French agreed to pay for it, to let him go, despite the fact that Jean seems to have genuinely loved his time in, and I put this in huge quotation marks, captivity. By the way, can I just say, Jean II has one of the best epithets of any French king, because he was called Jean the Good, which means he was called Jean le Bon.
Jean le Bon!
It's really good.
Jean le Bon.
We are from France. So, while his kingdom was struggling to raise the money for his enormous ransom, Jean le Bon was living well in London, shall we say. We know from his account books that he was purchasing horses, pets, and clothes whilst maintaining a court astrologer and a court bard. So, the English hold Jean le Bon until 1360, when he returns to France. Again, the kingdom is completely bankrupt, has been devastated by war. The treaty that releases him, by the way, cedes an enormous swathe of southwestern France to be ruled by the English king. This is the high watermark, I would say, of English power in continental Europe to this day. So Jean was pretty happy with the settlement, it seems, that was negotiated in 1360. But that doesn't matter much, because in 1364, he is succeeded by Charles V, who says, you know what, fuck all this, actually. This is a terrible treaty. Rips it up, basically, and invades English territory, pushing them all the way back to their heartlands of Gascony, and thereby reigniting the war again. So we had 4 glorious years of relative peace to be followed by more bloodshed. Charles V is very successful against the English and is able to completely transform the standings of France and England vis-a-vis one another in the war. In that he drives England really all the way back to almost to the sea, and is succeeded in 1380 by his son Charles VI. Now, Charles VI, again, inherited this very favorable political context and was widely beloved as a result by the French people, but from 1393, he suffered from recurring bouts of mental illness. And by recurring bouts of mental illness, I mean that sometimes, with no warning, he would fly off the handle and just start murdering everyone around him. Now, that's obviously not a sustainable situation for your head of state, especially given that this is supposed to be the guy that God picked to run your country. So, in order to keep the peace, Charles VI's wife sets up a regency to run the country. The problem is that now you've just created a new office of total power, and this sets off a new round of feuding, this time within the French camp, between two of the great lords of the kingdom. These are Louis, Duke of Orléans, and Jean the Fearless, Duke of Burgundy. I don't have a lot to say about Louis, the Duke of Orléans, except for the fact that he was brother of the king. I have quite a lot to say about Jean the Fearless. So, first of all, what's Burgundy? Well, the Duchy of Burgundy is this huge sort of almost state within a state, centered on the northwest of France, centered around Dijon. But it also controls the County of Burgundy, which is a state within the Holy Roman Empire. And they also have holdings in the north and of the kingdom in, like, Flanders and so on. So the Dukes of Burgundy are these players in international politics, even as they are technically vassals of the French king. Now, Sorry, Jean got the nickname The Fearless because of his actions at a battle that longtime listeners of the Weird Medieval Guys will be getting sick of at this point. You know what it is.
Constantinople.
Well, almost. It's the Battle of Nicopolis in 1396.
Close enough.
So, longtime listeners will remember that beloved beloved inventor and medieval Brian Butterfield impersonator, Conrad Kaiser, blamed the defeat of the Christian crusade against the Ottoman Empire in 1396 on Sigismund of Hungary, who was the overall commander. But a huge part of the reason why the Christians were routed is because John the Fearless showed up with a huge bunch of Burgundian knights, refused to coordinate at all with any of the rest of the army, charged the Turks, got massacred, and the entire operation fell apart. He got thousands upon thousands of people killed, but he was still a war hero back in France.
Hell yeah.
Yay.
That was called failing upwards.
It's around this time, particularly at the closing decades of the 14th century, that the war really starts to leave France and starts to transcend national borders. Now, obviously, the war has been primarily fought in France, but this whole time, the Scots, who, remember, are allies of the French, have been leading raiding parties down into the north of England to terrorize the people of the north. But also, the kings of England and France are engaged in a sort of geostrategic war against each other, moving pawns around the board in other parts of Europe as well. So, for example, when there is a succession crisis in the 1360s over the crown of Castile in Spain, the French and the English back different sides in the resulting civil war, and thousands upon thousands of French and English and Spanish people die in that war, which is basically gets turned into a kind of mini battlefield of the Hundred Years' War. And in Wales, by contrast, in 1400, the Welsh nobleman, soldier, and lawyer Owain Glyndŵr decides that he is going to declare himself the new Prince of Wales and leads a rebellion that will drive the English finally out of Wales for the first time in 130 years. And he actually manages to set up an independent Welsh principality. And you want to know who backs him in that project and provides him with diplomatic and military aid?
Who's that?
It's the French and the Scots.
Of course.
So,
anti-English brigade.
Our friendship is based on our mutual distrust of England. So you see, the war is starting to touch all these different places in different parts of Europe that have no bearing on the original supposed question of who should succeed to the crown of France. In 1407, the conflict between the Duke of Orléans and Jean the Fearless comes to a head when Jean has Louis brutally murdered on the streets of Paris. And Jean has to flee Paris, but is absolved by the king 2 years later. But the result of that murder is outright conflict, and fighting starts between the supporters of the Duke of Burgundy and the supporters of the Duke of Orléans, who we will now call, from here on out, the Armagnacs.
Yes, and we have a couple quotes from the trial of Joan of Arc, from Joan herself, about encounters she had with the Burgundians and the effects that violence with the Burgundians had on her and her village. So we hear, quote, that asked if she was ever with the children who fought for her party, she answered no, as far as she remembered. But she sometimes saw certain children from her village of Domremy who had fought against those from Maxey, returning wounded and bleeding. And we even hear that asked whether in her youth she had any great intention of defeating the Burgundians, she answered that she had a great desire and will for her king to have his kingdom, even from a young age.
Yes. So meanwhile, things are going poorly in France and are going worse in France's allies. So the infant King James II of Scotland is a prisoner of the English. He was captured by pirates, if you can believe it. off the coast of Scotland.
I can't believe the pirates could have raised him as their own. Scotland could have had their first pirate baby king.
The Dread.
And certainly not their last. Yeah, exactly.
the dread Pirate James.
Yes, exactly.
God, that would... I wish we were that cool of a country.
Wait, that's
what the Italians would have done.
Yeah, wait, I can do it. Give me 15 seconds okay. And I'll come up with a punny pirate baby name.
Yeah. You're hearing how the sausage gets made, folks.
Yeah, wait, give me one sec. Okay, pirate names. We got like Jolly Roger, Blackbeard. Give me another pirate. Any more pirates?
More Jolly Roger, more like Jammy Dodger.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Well, that's not really not good baby enough. Related.
Babies like Jammy Dodgers.
Babies are jolly. No, I can't do it. I can't do it. I cracked under pressure.
A joke too far.
This is why I can't do improv.
This is why we don't do live shows.
Yeah, exactly.
Meanwhile, in Wales, Owain Glyndŵr's principality has been invaded again by the English, and his capital is captured, and he has to flee into the hills and mysteriously disappears and is never seen again, feeding into an existing legend that a sort of King Arthur-style once-and-future king will arise out of Wales and defeat the English in an apocalyptic battle, and finally a Welshman will rule the island of Britain once again. So all this chaos and civil war and instability inspires the King of England, who's now Henry V, this kind of grizzled, adventurous, very competent military leader, to attack in 1415. And this actually has the unexpected effect of uniting the two warring parties, the Armagnacs and the Bulgarians. The Bulgarians are around at this point. They're Burgundians and the Armagnacs, to unite their forces to defend the realm. And the problem is that is not adequate, because when the combined French armies face the army of Henry V at the Battle of Azincourt, well, you know how the Battle of Agincourt went.
Yeah.
Because nobody calls it the Battle of Azincourt. They call it the Battle of Agincourt because the English won it. And it was a slaughter. Once again, the English longbows are devastating. Of the 25,000 men in the French army, about 6,000 are killed, and an entire generation of the leading military leaders in France are captured, including the new Duke of Orléans.
Yeah, the new Duke of Orléans is around 21 years old at the time. His name is Charles, and he is found apparently unwounded, but trapped under a mound of corpses, which...
unpleasant.
Probably was not very pleasant, and his life only got worse from there because they brought him back to England. No, just kidding. He didn't seem like he had a terrible time in England. A little bit like Jean Le Bon. I guess it's a French aristocracy tradition. They threw him in the Tower of London, but they gave him, like, quite a posh suite. They give him, like, a bunch of attendants and, like, servants and just, like, mates. They move him actually around between a few different castles, and he gets to take his entourage with him, and he basically gets to go on, like, outings and day trips. We actually have pretty good records of his time in England, which was 25 years, by the way, because he became an extremely prolific writer of poetry. He learned English and started writing poetry in English. He also wrote loads and loads of poetry in French. And, like, a lot of the poetry was quite transgressive, very clever. A lot of it actually pushed the standards of what was conventional for poetry at the time. So, yeah, he was a pretty cool guy. They sent him back to France eventually, 25 years later, and got married, had a bunch of kids, basically just set up shop in the south of France and became a patron of the arts.
Yeah, it seems like he had a really extended gap year.
Basically, yeah.
So while he's away, control of Orléans passes to his half-brother, Jean de Dunois, who is referred to as the Bastard of Orléans. I wonder if we'll meet him again later. So after the defeat at Azincourt,
The truce between the Armagnacs and the Burgundians collapses, and the two sides just descend into civil war once again. This is now a three-pronged war between the Armagnacs, the Burgundians, and the English forces. By 1418, the Burgundians manage to take Paris and capture King Charles VI. However, his young son, the crown prince, or as they call the crown prince of France, the Dauphin, is able to escape. And this three-way war basically trundles on until in 1419, when the Armagnacs and the Burgundians seem to be approaching some kind of truce. In September 1419, Jean the Fearless meets the Dauphin on a bridge in Montreux for a diplomatic meeting, basically an opportunity to sort of hammer out what a deal to unite again against the English might look like. And the Dauphin's men fucking kill him. This is one of the sort of harder episodes in this story to explain. I think it was a power play, but it did not go to plan. Because the Burgundians are obviously outraged because the head of their house has just been murdered in cold blood by the crown prince. And the Burgundian party, now led by Jean's son Philip, decide that on the balance of things, they're probably better off throwing it in with the English. So in 1420, Charles VI, who we remember has been captured by the Burgundians, signs a treaty which disinherits the Dauphin, makes him no longer eligible for the throne, recognizes Henry V as regent of France, and signs Charles VI's daughter away to marry Henry. And this would mean a fusion of the English royal bloodline and the French royal bloodline that would seem to make English rule of France inevitable. You know, the Dauphin has been cut out completely and basically has to go on the run, retreating to Armagnac's stronghold south of the Loire River. And it seems like c'est fini. That's it. The Hundred Years' War is over, everybody. It ended in 1420.
It is funny that, like, while all of this stuff is happening, like, Uncle Charles is just in the Tower of London with his quill, being like, should I rhyme heart with art or part?
Put my letters over there.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, I mean, not to return to Charles again, although I do really like him, but, like, mm-hmm. He has all of these, like, poems that are like, oh, I'm at a castle in Dover looking at France. Like, oh,
you know. Some crazy stuff is happening
over there. I'm hunting in Cornwall thinking about France, and it's like, why is he thinking about France so much? His life is good. Anyways.
Yes.
But needless to say, if you, like me, like I did in preparation for this episode, read the Wikipedia page for 100 Years War.
God, you're so thorough.
Look, it's a good starting place. Then you'll know that it does not end in 1420.
Because whilst the Burgundians may have given up on the Dauphin, there is one party in this story who are absolutely, not only are absolutely loyal to the Dauphin, but will do anything whatsoever in their power to stop an English king getting a win. The world's greatest haters.
Wow.
Scotland! So, in 1418, in the midst of all of this chaos, the regent of Scotland, the Duke of Albany, appointed his son, the Earl of Buchan, to command a Scottish expeditionary force to France to help the French fight the English invaders. It was about 7,000 to 8,000 men, the largest Scottish army ever assembled outside of Scotland, and they arrive in France and don't make much of an impact for the first couple of years. In fact, mostly the only things that we know that they did was irritate the French nobility. There is the phrase that gets bandied around by the French nobility about the Scottish army is they call them drunken mutton eaters, which for anyone living in Germany who's just experienced the last month, I would say that they would probably agree with that. So after the treaty
where Henry V is recognized as the regent of France and the de facto ruler. The Scots don't actually back down. They double down and send another 5,000 men to support the Dauphin. But despite the Scottish army arriving, in the first sort of year or so after the treaty, the Armagnacs, such as they still exist, are very much on the run. They are barely holding on to what they have. It seems like it's just a matter of time until the Dauphin is captured and the whole thing falls apart. And especially, I should say, that because the Dauphin is the only living link that the Armagnac party have to any claim to the crown at this point, he can't actually be the figurehead of the army. So they are very much holding out for a hero at this point. Until 1421, at the Battle of Baugé, where the Earl of Buchan and his Scottish army meets the English army led by the Duke of Clarence, the brother of King Henry V. And I have a speech here that was given by the Earl of Buchan to his men at this battle that I think really inspired them to go out and win it. "All right, lads. We've been living off frog's legs and expensive wine for the last 2 years. It's time we actually did something about it. Now, we are here for one reason, and that is to help the Dauphin. I look at you men, and I see the faces of men who will climb over their own granny's corpse to stop the English getting a win. So let's do it. Let's go out there. Let's just massacre them. No Scotland!
No party!"
The battle is calamitous for the English. It's a complete rout. The Duke of Clarence is killed, possibly by Buchan himself. And the immediate response when the news reaches the Dauphin is that he's basically punching the air. Because it's like, this is it. We finally had a win. And he becomes a huge weeaboo for Scotland.
Yes.
So he recruits 100 of the best Scottish warriors to serve as his honor guard. I don't know if they still exist, but they were the royal guards of the French kings for hundreds and hundreds of years after that point.
It's just like the Varangians in Constantinople.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's just a worldwide tradition of importing freaky, scary guys from the north.
Freaky northern barbarians.
Yeah.
Apparently, it is said that the Dauphin, when he heard the news, turns to his nobles who had been disparaging the Scots soldiers for months and said, "What do you think now?" Anyway, so he meets up with the Earl of Buchan and he makes him the Constable of France, so the supreme commander of all French forces loyal to the Dauphin. And now, game on. Now we can get somewhere. So, game on. The momentum is back with the Armagnacs, finally. Again, thanks to Scotland.
Yes.
So it all seems to be going quite well. The Armagnacs are pushing north and with the Scots at their head until they meet the English at the Battle of Verneuil in 1424. This time they are joined by a huge contingent of Milanese heavy cavalry, and it's like, okay, let's do it. Let's play the same trick again. And fortunately, they get massacred.
Mamma mia.
I know. Or as they say in Scotland, oh my days. Including, by the way, the Earl of Buchan himself. So it's not only a material defeat, but also the sort of talismanic commander who you've sort of invested all of your hope in is now dead. It's bad stuff. And the Scots army at this point basically dissolves. The parts of it that are legitimately invested in the war effort and supporting the French are basically absorbed into the French armies and will spend the rest of this conflict as fighting on behalf of the French, no longer as a discrete Scottish army. Can I just say, this is emblematic of Scotland throughout history. Like, Scotland is not a very important country historically, but Scottish people are just fucking everywhere. And the Scots soldiers that don't join the French army get absorbed into the free companies. And this is where I have a theory that this is the origin story of John Grant, the mysterious flamethrower-toting
yes.
tunnel fighting Scotsman who was sort of a legendary figure in the Siege of Constantinople. If you want to hear more about him and why he's such a cool dude, just listen to those episodes, but not right now because we're in the thick of it. So this military defeat is bad enough. However, it comes in the context of things getting far worse for the Armagnacs politically, because whilst all this has been happening, two things happened. One, both in this 3 year window, both Charles VI and Henry V die, which leaves the nominal rule of France in the hands of the infant Henry VI. So the gambit that Henry V created has paid off just unexpectedly early. There is now, in theory, an Englishman on the throne of France. So it is tremendously bad news if the Armagnacs can't win on the battlefield. So for the next couple of years, the English and the Burgundians press their advantage, driving the Armagnacs further and further back until they are pressed all the way back to their stronghold south of the Loire River. And the last sort of stronghold that's holding out, that is sort of keeping the English from advancing further, is Orléans, which is besieged by the English in October 1428. And it seems very likely that the city will fall and the entire Armagnac operation will just completely fall apart. Until a serious peasant girl shows up at the Armagnac court in Chinon, claiming to be a messenger of God. Well, we are going to leave it on that cliffhanger. And guess what? This was supposed to be one episode, but now this is going to be two episodes.
Yeah.
Because we had too much to say about the Black Death.
We did the thing that we normally do, which is, you know, we sat down to record, and after getting through about half of our material, I looked at the laptop and saw that we had recorded, like, 2 hours. But usually when we do this, it's because, like, 50% of what we've recorded is just me being like, if Edward V was a dog, he would be a beagle. But if Edward III was a dog, he would probably be like a basset hound. But this time
It was all content.
It was all content.
Yeah. So we are going to... I know we said this was a three-part series. This is now a four-part series.
Oops.
It may become a six-part series. We'll see.
Yeah.
I think you're on this journey with us.
Strap in.
So we are going to leave you in this scarred, brutalized, almost post-apocalyptic landscape and this desperate scene and these people who have suffered and endured so much. We're going to see in the next episode whether or not they can find their hero. All right. Olivia, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Weird Medieval Guys, or my personal account is at Olivia_MS, and my home address is... No, just kidding. You have to subscribe to the premium tier of my Patreon for that. And Aaron?
I am at Aaron P. Tappers on Twitter, at Aaron on Blue Sky.
And if you enjoy our podcast and you wish to support the work that we do, you can do so by leaving us a 5-star review on Spotify, Apple, or any other listening platform of your choice if you feel our show deserves that. And on Spotify, you can even leave us a little comment in the "What did you think about this episode?" box. And we might read that comment out live on the podcast. Well, not live, actually.
How about this one from Altus Sai, who says, "Every day I check the podcast to see if a new episode got released. This is truly the highlight of my day. I wish the schedule was weekly, since I desperately need some more medieval history to listen to." That's a very nice thought, but I'd die. We'd both die.
Also, you don't have to check it every day. We release every other Friday.
Yeah.
Just so you know. And thank you to Nate Syndergaard, who on our most recent episode said, OMG, you guys made my week. Thanks for the shout out. I am forever a devoted listener. Thank you, Nate, for listening. This comment made my week. Thank you. I am forever a devoted reader of your sweet comments.
All right.
All right. We're going to go probably house a frozen pizza or something and then get back to recording.
Yes, we're going to meet Big J. J Money.
I won't see.